life we had at Glen Welby. It was not unnatural that Phil would want to create a nice farm out of this ramshackle place he'd bought, but I found it haunting that the life he was reconstructing seemed to be a mirror image of everything we had done together. The farm, the house near Georgetown he eventually rented, and even his trips to Sioux Falls, Phoenix, and Puerto Rico, all of which were places where we had been together. I went to Florida to see Bill Graham to ask his advice. Bill was a true support for all of us throughout those months. After our talks, Bill flew me up to Hobe Sound to visit Douglas and Phyllis Dillon, two loyal friends. While I was there, I called the post switchboard to connect with my house. The operator made a mistake, and before I knew it, I was connected with the farm, and Robin was answering the phone. I hung up instantly, but the mistake let Phil know I was out of town. I then got a wire from him asking if he could see the children at the house alone. I was so tense about everything that I left the Dillons at once and flew home early to prevent Phil's coming over. I think now that I may have been too rigid at first about not letting him visit with Bill and Steve. They missed him and wanted to see him, but I was frightened by the unpredictability of his behavior. I didn't trust him or believe him. I didn't have a very clear idea of his condition and just reacted emotionally. Life, for all of us, settled into a strained and endlessly painful pattern. I was on my own, trying to hold things together for myself and for the children. I kept working on the Junior Village project and was also engaged in an undertaking to start a modern art museum in Washington. But Phil still dominated our lives. He wanted to see the children and to have them, particularly Lally, meet Robin. I feared he would even introduce her as their potential stepmother. This wouldn't have been the end of the world, I suppose, but not surprisingly, I thought at the time that it would be. When Phil telephoned, the boys would go into a room and close the door, with me fully aware that they were experiencing the worst of all worlds, not being able to talk to one parent about the other. It was excruciating for all of the children in different ways, but especially hard on Lally. She showed great wisdom and strength and love for him, but not for what he was doing or the people around him at that time. She agreed to see him in New York, but found herself in a large group, including Robin, and firmly said that she didn't want to be a part of that. Don, too, was very vulnerable and supportive of both of us. We finally worked out times when Phil would take Bill and Steve out by himself, usually picking them up from school to avoid encountering me. I continued to get reports from mutual friends about where Phil was and what he was up to, or I heard about his activities directly, in part because some of what he was doing was spectacular and quite public. At other times, things were quieter, but I would be aware of what Phil and Robin were doing because of bills or other mundane things that brought their comings and goings into my sphere. They seemed to be settling in together. I got wind of credit cards having been established for Robin, and that Phil had separated our billing in the country so that everything at Glen Welby was in my name and everything at the Pearson farm was in his. When Phil's secretary, Charlie Paradise, asked me if I wanted to be listed in the phone book as Mrs. Catherine Graham rather than Mrs. Philip Graham, another small but severe irritation and wound, I said no. Even during these months when he was living separately from me, I could see indirectly that Phil was doing some things that made sense and others that were puzzling. One of the more bizarre occurrences of this difficult time took place from February 22nd to 26th, when Phil went up to New York and inserted himself, uninvited and unwanted by the publishers, into the New York newspaper strike with the firm conviction that he could settle it. Here again, Phil involved President Kennedy, calling him to discuss the implications of the strike. In his 1975 book, Conversations with Kennedy, Ben Bradley recalled, "Holding his thumb and forefinger close together, the president said, 'The line is so damn narrow between rationality and irrationality in Phil.'" On March 1st, Phil finally left for 2 weeks in Puerto Rico with Robin, during which time he again began buying things, arranging to rent with an option to acquire 2 apartments. Though these were ostensibly for the company, he and Robin intended to use them. He even wrote someone that they might make Puerto Rico their home base, rather than the Pearson farm. A few weeks earlier, Phil had had an argument with Russ Wiggins over an editorial about de Gaulle that Phil wrote and wanted to run in the paper. He had a kind of fixation on de Gaulle, seeing him as a great man standing alone. Phil wanted to fire Russ at some point during one such argument, but Al Friendly said, "If he goes, I go." Faced with the loss of both top editors, Phil had backed down. Now he sent Russ an editorial he himself had written about the newspaper strike, which he wanted printed in the Post. He also sent along 7 pages he had typed himself that were highly critical of the editorial the Post had run on the strike, saying he should have been consulted, and even suggesting an apology in print for the earlier editorial at the same time that the paper ran his. Russ not only refused to run Phil's editorial, but said he would quit if the piece appeared. Phil backed down again, but it escalated his feud with Russ, to the point where Phil told Al Friendly to take over the editor's post. But Al again refused. Phil also wrote several articles, including one on Cuba that appeared in the Outlook section and generated many positive letters, one of which was from the president, who added a note to his letter saying, "I hope you will come by some day soon." But as Charles Roberts reported later, when Graham took to berating Kennedy over the phone, asking, "Do you know who you're talking to?" the president replied, "I know I'm not talking to the Phil Graham I have so much admiration for." The difficulties, indeed, were constant, for me, for Phil, and for the company and those trying to hold it together. The whole affair, as David Bruce noted in one of his diary entries, was inexpressibly sad. Chapter 17. I seemed to be living on another planet. The most painful moments, the ones that disturbed me the most profoundly, were those in which people reported to me that they had seen Phil, and that he appeared to be rational and calm, indeed quite well. Even Fritz Beebe at one point told me he seemed fine. I had begun seeing Dr. Cameron by this time, and he assured me that people in these states could appear very normal for defined periods of time when they wanted to, but that fundamentally Phil was not rational, that he was ill. Even so, despite his assurances, the apparently normal encounters Phil was having with others shook me, about him and about us. Was this the real Phil? And was this what he really wanted? If so, what did that say about our relationship, about our 22 years together? What he seemed to be saying was that whatever was the matter with him was my fault, and here was the girl of his dreams, and all he needed was to be rid of me and to be with her and with the Post. Among my staunchest allies were the Restons. Scotty had seen Phil at 2 or 3 critical moments. According to him, Phil thought my religious faith could help him. He thought inaccurately, as it turned out, that I had this deep faith of my mother and father, which I wish I did have, but I did not have at that time. I did not tell him that. I told him that I thought that there were times in life when you go through all these things, and did he have any feelings about religious faith that could help him through this period, and he said no, he did not. And I don't know what I said to him that time, but it obviously was a failure. I was not able to get through to him, probably because I couldn't define it myself in any persuasive way, and by then he just went away. One day, during this period when Phil was away, I myself went to see Scotty and Sally in a terrible state of despondency. Scotty remembers thinking that I was giving up, that I didn't seem to have the strength to go on. He said to me, "Kay, you've got to fight for this paper. It does not belong to Phil Graham. Your father created this paper. There is not room in Washington for 2 Graham families. You and I can't do anything about Phil, but we can start training Donnie, and I would like to take him as my clerk this summer," which he did. The other person who stiffened my back was Louvie Pearson, who was the closest, most helpful, most ever-present friend throughout all those months. She somehow transmitted to me some of her own extraordinary strength and originality. The most important moment, one I will always remember, took place when the 2 of us were walking in Montrose Park, across the street from my house. I was talking about hanging on to the paper until the children, especially the boys, since in those days that's how I thought, were old enough to run it. I recall Louvie firmly and distinctly saying, "Don't be silly, dear, you can do it." "Me?" I exclaimed. "That's impossible. I couldn't possibly do it. You don't know how hard and complicated it is. There's no way I could do it. Of course you can do it, she maintained. Sissy Patterson did it, so can you. And to counter my disclaimers of impossibility, Luvy added, You've got all those genes. It's ridiculous to think you can't do it. You've just been pushed down so far you don't recognize what you can do. That was the first time that anyone had mentioned the idea of my running the company, or that I had even contemplated it in passing. The whole notion struck me as stunning and ridiculous, wrong-headed but sweet, coming as it did from my good loyal friend who was trying valiantly to buck me up, but who obviously didn't understand what running the business was all about and what it would take. Though I didn't think much more about going to work myself, I did think a lot about what Luvy and Lorraine before her had said about Phil's attitude toward me, and I began to realize how he had been treating me, especially in the past few years. Jean Friendly later recalled certain times at Glen Welby when Phil was being very peculiar. He was charming to the children and nasty to you. He was so mean at that point to you, I couldn't get over it. She correctly understood that I always viewed it as a joke, and thus didn't see the comments and behavior as put-downs. After Phil's return to Washington from Puerto Rico, I got a call saying he wanted to meet me at the R Street house to discuss the divorce and to pick up some of his things. I called Luvy and told her what had been proposed. "Listen, dear," Luvy said, "you don't need this. I'll come and pick you up right away, and we'll drive out to my farm." I was frightened at the idea of seeing Phil face to face, and uncertain how to handle it, so I readily agreed to Luvy's plan. We drove away in haste, spent the day at her farm, and returned to find that he had packed up most of his clothes and possessions and had apparently been angry at my absence. At one point that spring, Polly Wisner and another friend, Otsi Leiter, urged me to go to New York with them to see the ballet. I had mostly been staying at home, where I felt comfortable. Being in my own house with the children gave me some sense of routine, as if everything hadn't fallen apart. I had particularly stayed away from New York, because that was part of Phil's and Robin's turf. I hated thinking of them in our apartment at the Carlisle, and at Newsweek, and at other spots Phil and I had frequented. Both Polly and Otsi, however, thought this New York foray would be a nice diversion. On the contrary, it turned into one of those star-crossed occasions when a good idea goes sour by happenstance. Before the ballet, we were having dinner at 21 when Leonard Lyons, the gossip columnist, came up to us and said he'd heard Phil and I were getting a divorce and he was off with another woman, and was that true? I found my food hard to swallow after that interruption. Then we went on to the theater and discovered that our tickets were for the next night. So we bought whatever last seats were left in order to save the evening from being a complete bust. No one conspired against this expedition. The whole fiasco was accidental. Nevertheless, it gave me a feeling of complete rejection and exclusion. I felt that no one cared, that I didn't count anymore, and that life was passing me by. All the good things were going to Phil. I was certainly vulnerable, ready to be wounded, so that even a petty misfortune, like the tickets, seemed to be a straw breaking more than the proverbial camel's back. The trip to cheer me up brought me down lower than ever. Many of our friends were caught in a bind. Quite often they were pushed by Phil to receive Robin. For the most part they didn't, but said they would when things between Phil and me got sorted out. The Friendlies were particularly strong about stressing their love of him and loyalty to him, but their disinclination to accept the new arrangement until it was legal. There was one sharp exchange by letter between Phil and David Bruce over David's refusal to have lunch with Phil and Robin, which David had said would be untimely. Phil testily and angrily responded that there could be only one act that he felt David would really consider untimely, and that would be the act of being rude to a lady and disloyal to a friend. Several days later, Phil wrote David again, saying he had been hurt and baffled, and telling him, "I am always your friend. I apologize for stupidly thinking you could ever act toward me out of any motive but the highest kind." There were very few happy times for me in those months. One was when Pamela Berry came to visit me over a weekend. Pamela was the wife of Michael Berry, later Lord Hartwell, owner of the London Daily Telegraph. She was an intelligent, strong, articulate woman with a great wit, a leading London hostess, and quite a political force in England. Though we were all friends, she was known to prefer men, so I naturally thought she was more Phil's friend than mine. But she connected almost entirely with me during this time. It was very reassuring to have her come stay with me and express such solidarity. During this period, my mother was also very supportive, although she had to be restrained from occasional impulses to write Phil or get in touch with him on the theory that she had a special relationship with him, which in a way was true, but in a more important way was not. At one point, she signed a will in which my brother, Fritz Beebe, and I, and a bank representative, signed an agreement about property going to descendants, from which I suppose we omitted Phil. Each one of these moves was its own trauma, reminding me of the painful reality with which I now had to deal. Most of the time, I lived in a dream that we would get past this nightmare and that normal life would somehow return. New York seemed to be Phil's home base when he and Robin weren't in Puerto Rico or at the farm, but he made several trips to Washington. Once he had dinner with Bob McNamara, and the next day went to the White House to call on the president. Phil had earlier written Kennedy asking if he could stop by, saying, "If there is any chance of seeing you late that afternoon, I promise to be on my best behavior." This is one of the few times he acknowledged that there might be a problem with his behavior. More often than not, he was adamant in his denial that anything was wrong. Whenever anyone wrote him suggesting that he'd been ill, he at once responded testily, writing to one man, "I am not, nor have I been, seriously ill." In response to Hugh Kindersley, an English friend of ours who had written Phil that he'd heard he was ill, Phil wrote, "If the Daily Telegraph said I was taken ill in Phoenix, it was partly right, because I was certainly taken." In a letter to David Astor in England, he spelled out his intentions. "You have kindly written me a note worrying about my being ill. I am not, and have not been, ill, but I have managed to start getting a divorce in a rather turbulent manner. When the divorce is through, I plan to marry a proper Commonwealth lady, Miss Robin Webb from Sydney, Australia." Phil spread the word far and wide, even apologizing in some of his routine correspondence for being late in responding because, "I have also been somewhat occupied in the earlier stages of the unfortunate business of getting a divorce." He wrote to all of our friends in London and Paris, telling them he was planning a month-long trip to Europe and would be coming with Robin, whom he was going to marry. Evangeline Bruce wrote me from London that our friends were dreading the visit, fearing that, since they had basically decided not to receive Robin, Phil might try to trap us into lunching with him at a restaurant alone, and then they'd find her with him, and there would be some awful scene. She also noted that Isaiah Berlin was planning to stretch out his hernia operation and recuperative period to cover the entire time Phil would be in London. Evangeline added that Phil's insistence on taking Robin everywhere led them all to speculate on whether he would find a way to smuggle the little woman into his interview with the PM. Pam Berry wrote that they were all dreading the arrival of Phil, and added, "I don't think she will find London a very social city. I can't believe the trip will be a success compared to all the fun he is accustomed to having, and has had in the past. It is all so sad and horrible, I can hardly bear it for you all. I will write and describe the visit, that is, if, which seems unlikely, I witness any part of it." Before going to Europe, Phil, taking Robin with him, flew to California for RAND meetings, where apparently there was vast discomfort over her presence at the business-related dinners. Then, on April 19th, they left for London. Evangeline wrote me a detailed report of what she knew and had seen. "He seemed tense, and the contrary of healthy, and sad that particular morning. It was the one after he had talked to Stevie on the telephone for his birthday, and sort of volcanically tamped down. Apart from that, hard to tell. We kept off certain subjects, like divorce. After 10 minutes or so, Phil asked if I would change my mind and meet R. I said no, and this was the opening to say why and what I felt about the blackmail mutual friends had been subjected to in this respect. Took it well, but heaven knows how he really took it. The grapevine will tell. Lots of things he said were so patently untrue. Pam can tell you much more of this, since he saw her 3 times for hours. Isaiah, too. Incidentally, brave old Isaiah told Phil what he felt about his financial behavior, the 51%, etc., etc., and appeared to meet with reasoned arguments, but could see a black rage mounting. He was also treated to many a Zionist argument. Isaiah, who had deliberately arranged for his surgery to be done while Phil was in London with Robin, wrote me, "Phil telephoned to me and visited me twice in my hospital room. On the first occasion, not one word was said about any personal matter at all. This was queer, but I did not bring it up. Neither did he. He was acutely nervous throughout, and although he talked quite sanely and even interestingly about the Kennedys, etc., I could see that this was not what his mind was on. However, I did nothing to let him off the hook, and lay back in my exhausted condition and smiled wanly from time to time, and in the end the nurses had to ask him to leave. On the next day he returned, and there was a certain amount of personal talk, from which I gathered that he does indeed want a divorce and hopes to see you to discuss it with you, etc. He has an iron control of himself at the moment, but within some kind of devils are certainly still at large. On the other hand, it is quite impossible to say that he is in any respect insane. His own account of his incarceration had a wonderful grim humor about it. I had no idea whether what he said was accurate. It certainly didn't tally with the accounts of others, but I didn't practice any inquisitorial methods. I merely made clear my devotion to you and left it at that. He claimed to harbor no resentment or bitter feeling towards you of any kind. I did not see the lady, nor was she mentioned, except very glancingly. It was not suggested that I should see her, and I behaved as if she did not exist. I have no idea whether any banquets were held, or how much entertainment occurred, since I really was absolutely out of everything. In advance of this trip, Phil had planned for a meeting of Newsweek's overseas correspondents. They arrived from all over the world to meet with the editors in London, and he made a speech to this group, demonstrating yet again his ability to function at a high level even in the face of his illness. He began his remarks by describing the company, saying, "I have been responsible for its affairs for 17 years, and for the last 15 years, since it became a corporation in 1948, I have been controlling owner of its voting shares." There was no mention of my father, or how this came to be, or the existence of me as a minority owner, of course. He ended his remarks with some philosophical thoughts, including a phrase about journalism's being the first rough draft of history, which is quoted to this day. "I am insatiably curious about the state of the world. I am constantly intrigued by information of topicality. I revel in the recitation of the daily and weekly grist of journalism. Much of it, of course, is pure chaff. Much of our discussions of how to do it better consist of tedium and detail. But no one yet has been able to produce wheat without chaff, and not even such garrulous romantics as Fidel Castro or such transcendent spirits as Abraham Lincoln can produce a history which does not in large part rest on a foundation of tedium and detail, and even sheer drudgery. So let us today drudge on about our inescapably impossible task of providing every week a first rough draft of a history that will never be completed about a world we can never really understand." While Phil was in London, I tried to pick up the pace of my life a little. My mother and I together planned a large reception at her house for May 7th, to which we invited hundreds of people. Mother called it a show-the-flag party, a way to assure people we were still here and still okay, despite Phil's efforts to take over. It served its purpose. On May 11th, after going to Paris, from London, and then on to Ravello for 5 days of rest, Phil and Robin flew back to the States, and after taking care of some things in Washington, he and Robin left again for Puerto Rico. I went on seeing close friends and going out a little more. One person I saw was David Bruce, to whom I talked about my plans and intentions and my resolve not to give Phil a divorce unless he gave up at least enough of his controlling stock in the Washington Post so that I would have the majority interest. I'm not sure how I came to this conclusion, but I do know that my determination was total. I was not going to lose my husband and the paper. And if my husband was firm in his decision to leave me, then I would fight to keep the paper. The chain of events and activities quieted down, and an audible silence was emanating from Puerto Rico. I suspected that my not hearing much from there meant that Phil had become depressed, and indeed he had. Being there hadn't cured his exhaustion. Instead, the calm and inactivity seemed to have given him time to think and added to his depression. When they returned to New York from Puerto Rico on June 12th, Ed Williams met them at the airport, and it was Ed's view that Phil was the worst he had ever seen him, really so depressed it was like he was paralyzed, physically paralyzed, with almost an inability to move. It's hard to sort out whether he returned intending to remain with Robin or break up with her, but they did come to Washington and move into a large house on Foxhall Road. A few days later, on Monday, June 17th, Phil consulted both Dr. Farber and Ed, and in effect told them that it was all over. He wanted to end the affair with Robin. Farber, typically, was again questioning and indecisive. He asked Phil if he was sure. Ed stepped in and asked Phil three questions. Did he want Robin to leave? Did he want Ed to ask her to leave? Did he want to come home if I would have him? To all three questions, Phil, in an agony of despair and depression, answered yes. Poor Robin took the shuttle to New York, and Al Friendly went to spend the night with Phil in the house on Foxhall Road. The next day, Phil's brother Bill again came up from Florida and stayed with him, as did Fritz Beebe. On that same Monday, I got a call from Al saying that Phil wanted to come back if I would agree, which I did immediately. On the afternoon of June 19th, Phil returned to R Street and spent the night. Having Phil back was a tremendous and tremendously complicated relief. For me, one of the immediate questions was whether I could go through another black depression with him. I knew all too well what it was like, not being able to leave the house except when he was at his doctor's, hours and hours of intense talk, hearing things I wasn't sure I wanted to hear or know about. All of those years we had labored through together to get him out of the depressions had resulted in his leaving me. None of my efforts had led to a happy ending, and I felt I just couldn't assume once again the heavy burden and responsibility of being his sole support system. Clearly, we needed intensive outside help. Phil almost pathetically asked to be allowed to stay at home, not to go back to Chestnut Lodge, which I viewed as the only option. I don't believe any of us thought there might be an alternative to Chestnut Lodge at the time, and in terms of Phil's treatment, I assumed that the psychiatrists knew what they were doing and didn't question whether the lodge was the right or appropriate place or whether Farber was the right doctor. This decision-making about whether to go to Chestnut Lodge or stay at home was horribly painful, made a little less so by Ed Williams and Bill Graham, who both felt Phil should go, and by Phil himself, who in the end went sadly but willingly. Our loyal driver, Tony, drove him to the lodge late in the day on June 20th. At some point that evening, when several of us were at the lodge with Phil, I saw Ed for the first time since Phil's last illness had begun. There was a room full of people, but on instinct I went up to him and very quietly thanked him for everything he'd done, saying, "I can see you did the best for him." When I later met with him to go over what had happened and how he viewed it all, he told me that his one idea had been to hold on to Phil. What Ed had done was right. With his ability to appraise people and situations, he had been very aware of Phil's mental state at almost every turn and very clear about his instability. At the same time, he was determined to do the best he could for him under the circumstances. Ed's devotion to Phil was not unlike mine, unswerving and uncompromising, and his behavior at this time created a lasting bond between us. The day after Phil went back to Chestnut Lodge, Al Friendly wrote him, "At the rock bottom of despair, and against the hardest opposition conceivable, you made the toughest decisions possible. When every thought was an agony to frame, your mind remained the best and most exciting one I know. With those resources, how can even you doubt that you will succeed in what you have to do? There will also be the help from the love of more friends than you know. I'll see you soon, whenever you'd like me to." Lally, who was working in the Newsweek Washington Bureau that summer, wrote about the mid-June events to my mother, whom she was going to be joining in Greece for another yacht trip. "Last night he went in the hospital, and Donnie and I were both so glum about the future. But this morning I really feel certain that he will indeed come through it. Mummy seems greatly cheered by the last 2 days during which he's been at home. I am greatly cheered that despite the fact that he feels there is so little to live for at the moment, he has been so incredibly courageous, strong, and kind. Not only did he get rid of the girl, but he also managed to dismiss Farber, which I think in ways was even harder, for Farber was really his only ray of hope in the past few days, since he told Daddy that he knew he could pull through his depressions and do it without a hospital, and also that although the words manic-depressive might be a very adequate description of his past behavior, they did not necessitate a future cycle. Obviously, giving up Farber meant giving up the hope of going through the depression without a hospital, and also accepting the label of manic-depressive. I wince at the thought of the agony he must be experiencing. It must be so frightening to realize that your whole life is governed by cycles in which you are either irrationally happy or just as irrationally depressed. Enough. I just hope so much that somehow all this can be cured, or at least helped. Lally's letter suggests Phil's still positive feelings about Farber, although he himself had dismissed him as his doctor. Indeed, he was attached to him, partly, I think, because Farber espoused ideas Phil agreed with and played down any idea of real mental illness. Perhaps his dismissal of Farber at this point was an indication of just how low Phil was, that he no longer believed Farber and knew the sickness would recur. The letter also reflects that, at last, a name had been given to this illness. To me, Phil seemed, as usual, to be truly courageous, positive, and hopeful in the face of terrible anguish. In a letter to my mother, he said, "What seemed for some moments an end, I must now turn into a beginning. With Kay's singular love, with that of the children, with yours, with that of my brother and that of friends, I know I can do it. A beginning scaled to decent human values. At least I do so pray." There was a short interlude after Phil went to the lodge before I started to visit. Then I went pretty much every day for several hours. I often took picnics, and we'd sit outside to eat. Occasionally, we'd play tennis or bridge. Gradually, a few friends started to visit him, but mostly they were from the family or the company. Billy and Steve had gone off to camp. Lally went abroad to visit the Berries in England before joining my mother's yacht party in Athens. Don and I were alone at R Street, he working all day for Scotty Reston. Scotty wrote Phil, saying that he had had two guys doing this job at the Times for him, but that Don Graham, in his sophomore year at Harvard, is better than either of them. He has come in here very quietly and composed sometimes as many as 60 letters a day and written them simply and quickly and done a lot of other things on the side. Everybody likes him. Bob McNamara was very good about visiting Phil at Chestnut Lodge. One Saturday morning I was playing tennis with Bob's wife, Margie, and she told me that Bob had said to tell Phil he was coming to see him later that afternoon. I said I'd ask Phil to see if he was up to it, but Margie replied that Bob, who thought it would be good for Phil, had insisted on just announcing that he was coming. It was so typical of Bob, who was working at the Defense Department at a feverish pitch, to conclude that that was the best approach, and to take time on a Saturday afternoon to drive an hour to Chestnut Lodge. Phil demurred, but eventually agreed to see him. Phil and I sat together on a bench under a tree, waiting for the long black official limousine, which eventually swung into the driveway. I left the two men alone to talk. Bob's recollection of what he said to Phil was, "God damn you, get out of here. Come down and help us. We need you." And Phil said he couldn't, in effect saying that nobody would accept him. Bob assured him that he knew more about the Defense Department than almost anyone, and repeated that he should get down there and help out. Bob later told me that he said all this partially because he thought that's what Phil needed to hear, but more because it was basically true. He felt strongly that Phil had an extraordinary insight into the nation and how to deal with its problems. One thing Bob recalled was that when he asked Phil what he should be doing to help, Phil replied, "Well, the first thing I'll tell you is not to waste your time coming out here." Although, of course, it was hard, I was ecstatic about Phil being back, even if in the hospital. Naturally, I dropped nearly all of my activities, including a planned trip to Europe, to concentrate on him. He remained seriously depressed, but seemed to me to be already quite noticeably better, even after only a week or so at Chestnut Lodge. I felt he finally had doctors who were treating a real and known illness, and because of that I was able to hope that we could, as I wrote a friend, surmount the difficulties of the last few years. Although I still naively believed that Phil could and would get better, on some level I think even I was beginning to recognize that this was wishful thinking. I wasn't on sure footing when it came to what to talk about with him, but advised one friend who wanted to write that he loves love at this point, and also any sort of news or political gossip that you can think of. Phil was full of remorse and guilt and sadness. He, who hated to hurt people, had to begin to deal with all the hurt his actions had wrought, for me, for the children, for Robin, for himself. It's hard to imagine his frame of mind, knowing he had left his home and children, had sent for Robin more than once, and then in the end had told her it was over and had come back home to us. Worry about his actions and what he had done to himself, his life, and to all of us was the main thing on his mind. That, plus the thought that not only had it happened, but it might happen again. It had finally penetrated to me that Phil's diagnosis was manic depression, but the whole issue of treatment, or indeed even what manic depression was, I didn't really comprehend. Although the illness was now named, I didn't know what its outcome usually was if not properly treated with a combination of drugs and psychiatry. I certainly didn't understand something that I learned later from Dr. K. Jameson, the author of An Unquiet Mind, about her own manic depression. She has written that it is a lethal illness, particularly if left untreated or wrongly treated. And of course, much less was known then. Lithium was only in the experimental stages, being used mostly in Europe. It wasn't in clinical practice here. Electric shock treatment had been used routinely with manic depression for decades, and at least should have been considered for someone who is severely depressed or severely manic. Though it had improved considerably since the 1950s, electric shock was still a rough therapy, with many cases of convulsions leading to cracked ribs and broken backs. It might still have been the preferred treatment at the time, but a place like Chestnut Lodge, which prided itself on psychodynamic or psychoanalytic treatment, would certainly not have used it. In any case, Phil had a deep aversion to both drugs and shock treatment, an antipathy that had been inculcated in him by Farber and reinforced by his having seen the negative effects on our friend Frank Wisner. Phil may have been a victim not only of Farber's peculiar form of psychotherapy, but of the timing of his illness and of his own anti-drug attitude. I don't know whether there still exists a branch of psychiatry that treats manic depression by shunning drugs and relying completely on talk therapy and discussions of existential philosophy, but I hope not. I don't believe you can reach people in the depths of depression or in the heights of mania through mere talking. It bothers me still that I was so passive about the nature of Phil's illness and so accepting of Farber for so long. I'm not sure why I didn't insist on more of an explanation. Perhaps I was just holding on to the naive notion that all would be well. I don't think I would have felt so optimistic had I seen something Phil wrote at that time, addressed to Scotty Reston but never sent. It was a little essay on balance and moderation and being middle of the road, all written out in careful longhand. This turned up later in Phil's papers, and I sent it to Scotty when I found it. It's hard to fathom why he addressed these thoughts specifically to Scotty and why he didn't send them, but they reflect thinking that, had we known of it, might have led us all to a different decision about whether he was ready to have a day away from the hospital. Phil wrote, "I find it unendurable to believe that balance or moderation or middle of the road represent human approaches to living. Similarly, we are told that all tough questions are matters of degree, of simply drawing a line, etc. What nonsense! It is not just a matter of degree involved in the chasm between freedom and tyranny, nor just a matter of drawing a line. One is an embracing of life as a holy project, the other is a rejection of all but the finite and temporal and material. Balance or middle of the road are blinders and deceivers. That kind of language inevitably carries the suggestion that one can finesse the problem through a sort of vegetable neutrality. That is highly appropriate for turnips, but not for men. Get right down to day-to-day living. How much should one pour into one's work? How much save for one's family? How much for solitary thought? How much for service to one's sovereign or one's God? How great is one's duty to truth? How do we ration our small supply of energy and talents and character amongst all the claimants? We know that there is no answer to those questions, and there could not be without stripping life of its most valued meaning. We know we have to face these and 1,000 other questions again and again, sometimes with vigor, at times with heavy fatigue, now in hope, again near despair, but always, so long as there is any life at all, facing again and again and again. How wrong it is to try to banish all this, to pretend it doesn't exist, by admonishing balance as an approach to life, or the middle of the road. The man who leaves life by the most violent suicide is still at least more honest than those who choose suicide while living by defining away all that is human in life. Phil very much wanted to go to Glen Welby for a break from the hospital and had started to work on the doctors to obtain their permission. There was a sharp difference of opinion among the doctors at the lodge about whether this was a good idea, but no one ever asked me if there was liquor or sleeping pills at the farm, nor did I think to mention the guns we had there. I, who certainly knew the farm was stocked with guns that Phil used for sport, was completely deluded by his seeming progress, lack of visible depression, and determination to get well. In fact, I was optimistic about his ability to do so. One doctor at the lodge told a friend later, Phil was determined to get out, and really was unbelievably masterful in his ability to manipulate people. He even got the patients to take a vote among themselves, and he went to them to argue his case and get them on his side. Naturally, they voted that he be allowed to go. During one of his hospital stays, Phil had confided to his friend and colleague, Jim Truitt, that when he was sick, he made people dance the devil's dance. Indeed, Dr. Cameron once remarked to me that someone like Phil, especially in his manic moods, could pull people into going along in some way with his madness, becoming part of it. When I look back, Anne Truitt said, I see Phil as a dervish. He's going round and round, dancing himself the devil's dance and pulling into his orbit, nearly magnetically, everyone whom he touched. I see now that we were all enablers, in the long run not helping him in the least in the end. Even I started asking people what they thought. I asked Ed Williams, among others, and he was very bothered afterwards that he had said yes, Phil should be allowed out. My own doctor, Dr. Cameron, who had an office at Chestnut Lodge, thought the whole idea of Phil's leaving the hospital for a weekend at the beginning of August was definitely premature. In any event, Phil won. And I must say I was glad. He wanted so much to go to the farm, and I got caught up in thinking how good it would be for him. He loved Glen Welby, and was always so happy there. The night before we were to go to the farm, I had dinner with my neighbor Kay Halley, whose brother-in-law was Dr. George Kreil, Jr., of the Cleveland Clinic. He walked me home and asked if Phil was being given drugs. When I said no, he expressed surprise and told me that, according to what he knew, drugs were absolutely necessary for Phil's future. I remained skeptical that Phil would ever agree to drugs, given his feelings about them, but I thought of pursuing this when he went back to the lodge after our time at the farm. On Saturday, August 3rd, Phil's driver picked him up at Chestnut Lodge, and then they came to R Street to get me. One of the things Phil had said he wanted to do was to work on farm problems while he was there, so I had asked Buck Knowles to come up to the house in the afternoon. I remember that Phil expressed surprise at my having asked Buck to come, no doubt having forgotten that he had mentioned working on the farm as one of his reasons for going there. We had lunch on two trays on the back porch at Glen Welby, chatting and listening to some classical records. After lunch, we went upstairs to our bedroom for a nap. After a short while, Phil got up, saying he wanted to lie down in a separate bedroom he sometimes used. Only a few minutes later, there was the ear-splitting noise of a gun going off indoors. I bolted out of the room and ran around in a frenzy looking for him. When I opened the door to a downstairs bathroom, I found him. It was so profoundly shocking and traumatizing, he was so obviously dead and the wounds were so ghastly to look at, that I just ran into the next room and buried my head in my hands, trying to absorb that this had really happened, this dreadful thing that had hung over us for the last 6 years, which he had discussed with me and with the doctors, but which he had not been talking about in recent weeks, when he was obviously most seriously thinking about it. The sight had been so appalling that I knew I couldn't go back in, so I ran to call Buck and our caretaker, William Smith, for help. They had heard the gunshot and appeared immediately. I finally went back upstairs to my bedroom and used a direct phone to the paper. There was a much-loved phone operator named Molly Parker who had been at the post almost 50 years, and luckily she was there. I told her what had happened and that I needed help. I made a call to Dr. Cameron and then just sat and waited. The next thing I can remember is the arrival of the local police, whom I suppose Buck and William had called. Finally, Alfred and Jean Friendly arrived, bringing Don with them. Don and I walked along the road, consoling and sustaining each other. What I was agonizing about was that I had let him leave the bedroom alone. I can only say that he seemed so much better that I stupidly was not worried enough. It had never occurred to me that he must have planned the whole day at Glen Welby to get to his guns as a way of freeing himself forever from the watchful eyes of the doctors and the world. He left no note of any kind. I believe that Phil came to the sad conclusion that he would never again lead a normal life. I also think that he realized the illness would recur. As K. Jameson has written, there is a particular kind of pain, elation, loneliness, and terror involved in this kind of madness. However he himself defined his illness, Phil was well aware of the damaging effects of it on others and on him. I think he felt he'd done such harm the last time around that he just couldn't deal with it, couldn't fix everything. It was unendurable to him not only that he couldn't make any of it right, but that he might cause more hurt again. I concluded all of this only later. At the time, I could barely deal with the reality of what had happened and begin to handle the shock to all of us. Essentially, I had gone through losing Phil twice. First, he left, and there was all the embittering agony of that time since Christmas. Then, to have that horror over, to have him back, was an impossible dream come true. But that, too, was now over, and a very different kind of grief consumed us all. It took most of the afternoon before we could leave Glen Welby. Al took charge, informing authorities, dealing with the practicalities, seeing that family and close friends knew. Someone, I suppose the local coroner, came and removed the body. One oddly distinct vignette in my memory is of a strange man walking into the library where Don and the Friendlies and I were sitting. We looked at him, puzzled, and he said, "I'm from the Washington Evening Star, and they sent me down to check on the story that Mr. Graham is dead." I just nodded, and Al took him out of the room. Finally, we got into the Friendlies' car to go back to R Street, with Don and me sitting together in back. About halfway to town, I asked the rhetorical question, "What's going to happen to all of us?" Al turned around and pointed at me without saying a word, distinctly meaning that I had to do it. But the whole notion went right past me, as did most everything else that day. When we got back to the house, some friends had already arrived, and more gathered. Finally, there was almost a wake of people, not one of whom I can remember except for Lorraine Cooper. I went to bed late that night, after everyone had left. Years later, Ed Williams told me that he had come over even later that night, he had no idea at what time, and walked right in the open back door. He had gotten very drunk and was looking for me. Distraught, he walked all around the blackened first floor, found no one, and left. The next day, the nightmare of the reality began to set in. Phil's death was the most unbelievable and awful shock to all the children, particularly the younger ones. Lally and Don, at least, were more aware of his illness and its implications. Bill and Steve, on the other hand, faced the suddenness of the loss without any preparation for an ending to the difficult months of separation. Bill, then 15 years old, flew home from camp. Lou Ekstrand, our housekeeper and sort of sitter, went to get Stevie. Don flew with Charlie Paradise to Idlewild Airport in New York to meet Lally and Louvi Pearson, who had also been on the trip with Mother and who accompanied Lally home. My mother wasn't up to the trip and stayed on the yacht. She sent me a heartfelt and sad wire, saying she needed us to come to her and urging me to return with Lally and Luvi. I am confused, and I hurt all over. What this tragedy must be for you, I cannot imagine. I wish only that I were near you. Here you will have companionship, but only when you want to. And I need you to help me face life. It is sad that I can offer you only my weakness, but it is the result of my feeling for you and my love for our lost darling. I can only say, come. A different world will distract you. Don also met Scotty and Sally Reston and brought them back, too, on the company plane. They had come home from Europe as soon as they heard. In one of the many phone calls in those difficult days, I had urged the Restons not to interrupt their trip, assuring them that I needed and wanted them, but later, and begging them not to come then, to which they replied, "We are coming." The next few days were what everyone goes through even with normal deaths, let alone the suicide of a prominent individual. Letters and telegrams and flowers began flooding in. I think I read very few of the letters then, but I read each of them carefully later. In an odd way, being active and making arrangements have a numbing effect and help get you over the cold realization of what has happened and the loss you are facing. Many people helped so much, especially the two older children, both with arrangements and with emotional problems and issues. Phil's father had had a series of strokes and had been quite ill. I'm not sure whether he was even told of Phil's suicide. He died several months later. Bill Graham was his usual wonderful self, helpful to me in every way. As difficult and sad as all of this was for us, Phil's family, it was also wrenching for his friends and for people throughout the company, the industry, and the city. The resonance at Chestnut Lodge, of which I was then unaware, was also immense. A great many wonderful things were written and said about Phil in the days after his death. The Post published a collection of his sayings and writings. An editorial said, "Mr. Graham invested the full capacity of his mind and heart in everything that deeply moved and interested him. He was not a person given to qualified commitments to his country, his enterprise, or his friends. It was this quality that precipitated the illness that led to his death. Our sense of loss is total. He was a man neither easily forgotten nor found again." Herb Bloch wrote a particularly moving farewell. Al Friendly said Phil could out-sleuth the paper's star reporters, outthink its fanciest or most fancied stylists. Russ Wiggins wrote a personal note to the staff. "Philip L. Graham has left in our daily care and custody an honest and a conscientious newspaper, which I know that all of you are eager to maintain as a daily memorial to his own genius and integrity. And now we must take up the duties he laid upon us, with a heavy heart, but nonetheless with a high hope that we may succeed in doing what he would have us do." Fritz Beebe was especially a hero in the days immediately after Phil's death. I was only dimly aware of the mountainous difficulties with which he coped. He maintained stability and continuity and some calm within the company, and was there for me as a friend and as an advisor. At the same time, he shouldered much of the heavy burden of dealing with the whole issue of there being more than one will. Phil, during the height of his last manic period, had written a new one. As Ed Williams later said, "Any will lawyer would have been horrified by the way I handled this, but if you just operate simply from your instincts, you do better." What Ed had done was extraordinary. Phil had begun pushing Ed to make a new will that would have given a third of Phil's estate to Robin, who Ed believed was not the instigator of this and may never have known how much she stood to benefit, leaving two-thirds in trust to be divided among the children. At the time, Ed thought that the worst thing he could do was to tell Phil that he wasn't going to help him make such a will, that in fact he felt Phil wasn't competent to do such a thing. He knew it would spell the end of their relationship. In trying to hold on to Phil, Ed wrote the will for Phil, but simultaneously wrote a memorandum for the file, saying he didn't think Phil was competent to make a will, and that he was doing it solely for the purpose of retaining a relationship with him and exercising what influence I could over him to get him back to his old life. Just after this will was executed, Phil went back to Ed and wanted to reverse the percentages, making Robin the recipient of two-thirds of his estate and the children one-third. This one was never actually executed. When Phil finally decided to leave Robin and to come home, he asked Ed to destroy the rewritten will, and it was officially torn up in front of witnesses. But although the Robin Webb will was invalid, a technical question remained. Did Phil's 1957 will have legal standing, or did he die intestate? This was resolved by a compromise, whereby I gave up part of Phil's estate in favor of the children, which was fine with me. The children eventually had to have their own lawyer, and after the funeral we all had to go to court to deal with the legal issues involved. I will never forget Steve, then only 11, dressed up in his little suit, straightening his tie and saying, "I have to go to see my lawyer." His remarkable and ever-present wit was with him even in these darkest of hours. As far as I know, Robin received nothing in the end, nor did she ask for anything, ever. She was carried away by Phil, and only slowly must have come to understand his illness. I believe that she called to ask if Phil had left a note, but she never reappeared in the life of my family, and she never gave an interview about her relationship with Phil. She must be a very decent person. I understand that she married an Australian diplomat and seems to live a quiet life. I hope that she, too, eventually recovered. On the day before the funeral, the board of directors of the company met. Fritz suggested that if I felt up to it, I should come to the office to say a few words to the directors, reassuring them that the company would go on and not be sold. I agreed, but was terrified. I thought about what to say, wrote it out, and even rehearsed. When the car arrived to take me downtown, Lally, in her nightgown and robe, hopped in and went along with me for comfort and support. I still have her touching and helpful handwritten notes on what she felt I should say, notes that she placed in my hands and which I relied on in what I said. 1. Thank them, all deeply involved. That gives you confidence. 2. There has been crisis and still is one, but you know they will carry on as they have over the past months. 3. Never expected to be in this situation. 4. Going off to clear mind and think about future. 5. No changes or decisions at this time. The paper will remain in the family, next generation. 6. And be carried on in traditions so well set. 7. Further thoughts. It touches me still that this young girl, who was, if anything, more devastated than I, could scribble out this simple but correct sequence of thoughts and jump in the car in her nightclothes to put them in my hand. I recall walking into the room where the all-male board was gathered. To a man, they looked almost as stricken as I was. They also seemed to be looking at me hard to decipher what was there. Oz Elliott later recalled what I said better than I could. "You said you appreciated very much how everybody had handled this very difficult situation with professionalism, and you just wanted to say that you knew rumors were around, and would be around, that the company would be for sale, or that some part of it would be, and you said that you wanted to make it clear that it was not for sale, no part of it was for sale, this was a family enterprise, and there was a new generation coming along." Knowledge of that new generation, my children, was what led me, however hesitantly, to the decision I made then, to try to hold on to the company by going to work. Phil's funeral was on Tuesday, August 6th, in the Washington National Cathedral, and was so big and so public that in a way it again shielded me from what was really happening. The children and I had all participated in deciding on the nature of the service and the selection of the hymns. President Kennedy attended. He came up the side aisle by himself after everyone was seated. The sun shone through the stained glass windows, somehow illuminating him as he walked to his seat. One jolt occurred when we left for the private burial. Others had been to the funeral home to make all the arrangements, but I didn't know the details. I did know from Phil's endless jokes that he had procured a plot in Oak Hill, the cemetery across the street from our house. It was extremely difficult to get in. The Dean Achesons, the David Bruces, and the John Walkers were all planning to be buried there, and Phil had developed an enthusiasm of an odd kind to be buried there, too. One night, long before he became ill, he came home from a St. Albans school board meeting and said there was a man on the board who was influential at Oak Hill, and he was sure we could have a plot. He went on joking about it, saying that all I would have to do was to wheel him across the street. I was deeply upset when we pulled up in front of the burial site to find that this was not an exaggeration. His grave is directly in front of a little chapel right across the street from my house, where I can see it every day. I like this now, but in the beginning it disturbed me a great deal. People came home afterwards. Touchingly, people from all over. It's funny how much you care who is there, and even somehow count the house at a moment like that. For friends to care and to come means something. Two messages came to me from President Kennedy. The one I received on the day of the funeral quoted Prime Minister Macmillan saying that when Phil called on him that summer, he had found him particularly attractive and interesting. The president then said, "I thought the service today was appropriate and moving, especially the last hymn. Phil was so helpful to me in so many ways since I have come here. We shall all miss him greatly, and I send you and the children my deepest sympathy." Jackie Kennedy wrote me an 8-page letter, one of the most understanding and comforting of any I received. Just a few days after Phil's funeral, Jackie gave birth to the baby boy who died. These days, from Phil's death through the funeral, that we all endured, are as hazy to me now as they were then. If there is one regret I feel, one enormous failing, it's that I was so overwhelmed that I wasn't thoughtful enough or helpful enough with the children whose trauma was even worse than mine. Phil was the bright shining light in their lives. Each of the four had been through the months of his absence only to get him back and then to lose him again. Lally and Louvi at some point began insisting that what I needed was to get away from everything. They pressured me to go back to Europe with them, as did my mother by cable. I felt it would be impossible. Even apart from the children, there was much too much to do, given the will, the estate, the company. Their rejoinder was that they had already packed for me and had my passport and that I was going. I finally agreed to the plan. Bill and Steve bravely returned to their camps. Don stayed at his job with Scotty, living at home and spending a lot of time at the Friendlies. I took off with Louvi and Lally the day after the funeral to join my mother's chartered yacht at Istanbul. That decision may have been right for me, but it was so wrong for Bill and Steve and even for Don, so wrong that I wonder how I could have made it. Would my younger boys have been better off going too? Would it have been better if I'd stayed home for them? This is, for me, the most painful thing to look back on. It's hard to remake decisions, and even harder to rethink non-decisions. Sometimes you don't really decide, you just move forward. And that is what I did. Moved forward blindly and mindlessly into a new and unknown life. Chapter 18. Left alone, no matter at what age or under what circumstance, you have to remake your life. When I came back in September 1963 from the trip around the Black and Aegean Seas to take up my life again, there was a great deal of painful loneliness, only somewhat dulled by work and by the necessity of tending to the children, my mother, the business, and the task of balancing them all. The cruise had been a reprieve of sorts. It certainly took me into another world. But I experienced it with a mix of emotions. The inner turmoil continued. Always in my mind was the climax of the years of secret struggle with Phil's illness, the shock of the suicide, the loss, and the eternal questions about why and what next. I didn't talk with anyone intimately on the trip. Mostly I kept my agonizing to myself. I couldn't stop reliving the awful moment of the gun going off, my springing up, racing downstairs, and finding him. The scene replayed in my head until I thought I might be going mad. It took a long time to get through that. To this day, a gun going off or any loud bang nearby affects me profoundly. Yet on another level, life carried on. The trip was diverting, no doubt serving my mother's purpose, bad as it was for my young boys left behind. For me, this was the first of many such trips in which looking around, observing, and learning became almost addictive. One vivid moment from the end of this interlude took place at a stopover I made on my way home to visit friends on the island of Spezos. As I was leaving, Chip Bolin asked me, "You're not going to work, are you? You mustn't. You are young and attractive, and you'll get remarried. I said emphatically that I was going to work. Chip actually meant what he said flatteringly. For a woman, being married was a goal, a way of life, at that time certainly the most desirable one. But I wasn't thinking about remarriage at the time. I also saw no contradiction between going to work and whatever happened in my private life. I suppose that without quite realizing it, I was taking a veil. On September 9th, the day after I returned from Italy, I did indeed go to work. More formally, I was elected president of the Washington Post Company at a meeting of the board of directors on September 20th. Often I have been asked how I had the courage to take over the company, and I've always replied that I never saw myself as taking over anything or becoming the true head of the company. I had no conception of the role I was eventually to fill. While recognizing the importance of controlling the company and having been willing to fight for it, I saw my job now as that of a silent partner, watching from the sidelines as I tried to learn about the company to which I had tragically fallen heir. I saw myself as a bridge to my children and viewed my role before they could take over as supporting the strong men, principally Fritz Beebe for the whole company, Oz Elliott at Newsweek, John Sweeterman, Russ Wiggins, and Al Friendly at The Post, and John Hayes in broadcasting, who were running things and learning what I needed to in case some big decision came to me as the holder of the A shares. I naively thought the whole business would just go on as it had while I learned by listening. I didn't realize that nothing stands still. Issues arise every day, big and small, and they start coming at you. I didn't understand the immensity of what lay before me, how frightened I would be by much of it, how tough it was going to be, and how many anxious hours and days I would spend for a long, long time. Nor did I realize how much I was eventually going to enjoy it all. My going to work, in the sense I defined it, seemed to be the only sensible step to take, and in some ways shouldn't have caused much astonishment. The years with my father, and later with Phil, were years of absorbing from them and often with them. Fortunately for me, they both believed in sharing what they were doing with daughters and wives. One strength I did bring to the company was some knowledge and appreciation of news and journalism. I knew the principal journalists on the Post relatively well. I knew Russ, Al, Charles Roberts, and Eddie Folliard as old friends, and had spent my life listening to talk about the news and about the company. I had some sense of whom to listen to. Rightly or wrongly, I felt competent to size them up. On the other hand, I felt awfully new and raw, and the job, even as I had limited it, looked very big. It seemed like the difference between watching someone swim and actually swimming. As I wrote a friend in late September, I am quaking in my boots a little, but trying not to show it. I felt terrified without Phil. I badly missed his guidance. Even with all the difficulties of the last few years, he had always been there to lean on. Though I had learned a great deal from him, I still felt insecure making my own decisions. What strength I did have derived from the last grueling year when I had had to carry the burden at home, but it had never occurred to me that he wouldn't be there at all. Ironically, at the same time I was wishing he was there, all that Phil had been made my job more difficult. His having done everything so well, and as it seemed to the world, so effortlessly, made it even more daunting for me. Not only had I mythologized him, but others shared the same idolatrous view, which added to my confusion. Everyone would come in and weep on my shoulder about him. As time passed, I developed more perspective and realized that my image of him was at some variance with the reality. He hadn't been as perfect as I thought. He had been brilliant and had achieved an amazing record, but of course there were attendant problems. My job was made infinitely harder by comparing myself not with the real Phil Graham, but with my exaggerated idea of his ability and accomplishments. Still, I didn't have as much energy as Phil had had, nor were my interests as broad, my knowledge nearly as deep, or my training as adequate. As I readily admitted, I certainly didn't feel in any way equal to running the Post the way he had run it. I wrote to an old friend that having me at the helm of the Post and Newsweek isn't like having Phil running them, but I feel like the President of the United States who said to Congress, "I am the only president you've got." I had to come to realize that I could only do the job in whatever way I could do it. I couldn't try to be someone else, least of all Phil. What I essentially did was to put one foot in front of the other, shut my eyes, and step off the edge. The surprise was that I landed on my feet. I did so largely for two reasons. One was Fritz Beebe and the circle of men who had served Phil so well and who remained in place to help me. The other was luck. Fritz was a life-saving presence to me and to the company. He himself was relatively new at business and at media, having only been at our company for 2.5 years, much of which he had spent simply holding things together and trying to